Syrian government forces enter an area held by militants in southern province of Dara after 10 years under a surrender deal. Iran slams the West for what it calls shameful double standard in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have protested in support of six Palestinians who escaped the high-security Israeli jail last week. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. Now, the Syrian army has entered Al-Yaduda township in the country's southern province of Dara after 10 years. The army reportedly entered the area with Russian troops. According to local media, the entry followed a Russia-brokered surrender deal with militants that came into effect on September the 1st. The deal allowed the army to take control of the strategic Dara al-Balad and gave residents there an opportunity to return home. Under the agreement, the militants should either leave the area or surrender their firearms if they choose to remain. Russia mediated the deal after weeks of tensions between the army and the militants. Dara al-Balad was the last stronghold of the militants in southern Syria. Mohammed Ali says that the recapture of the towns in Dara province will help residents there to resume normal life again.
This deal was not a surprise, because after the Dara al-Balad deal was reached, the notables of the western countryside of Dara sent messages to the Syrian government that they are willing to engage in a similar deal to the one that happened, of course, in Dara al-Balad. And it is expected that more and more villages that are under the control of armed groups over there in the countryside of Dara will follow those areas of Dara al-Balad and Al-Yadudi. Definitely, this is very important. Economically speaking, this would ensure the safety of a route between Syria and Jordan for trade exchange. Economically speaking, this will also give a chance for all of the residents in southern Syria to go back to normal life. It will give them a chance to rebuild the areas that were affected by the war for 10 years over there. So definitely this is important for all sides, for the residents, and for even the armed men who reconciled. They will have a chance to live their normal life back again.
Now, Iran has slammed the West for what it calls shameful double standard in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that the West has not only failed to put pressure on Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it also fully supported the regime. The official noted that Iran would continue to push for the disarmament of Israel and a nuke-free West Asia. The spokesman said that Israel, that's believed to be in possession of hundreds of nukes, is in no position to lecture NPT member states like Iran. Last week, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid accused Iran of marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid said that Israel will act if the world fails to stop Iran. Okay, now time to get some insight and see what other things about this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Mick Napier with the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. Also, Mimi Alham, journalist and writer with Al Mayed in English, will join us from Perth. So, Mick, is this a joke or what? Israel will stop Iran if the world fails to do that? What are they talking about? Iran, everybody knows about Iran's missile activity. 15 IAEA reports confirm that the nuclear program Iran is pursuing is peaceful, is not diverted toward military purposes. So what's Tel Aviv talking about?
Well, you use the word joke, but it's certainly a very sick joke. Let's look at the basic record, which is open, and anyone can check this. France and the UK helped Israel to develop its secret nuclear capability. I can't remember, it was France or Britain supplied the heavy water, but all the technology that reached Israel didn't come from the USA at that time, it came from Europe. But Israel is now determined to preserve its monopoly of nuclear weapons in West Asia. And that monopoly is very important to Israel. Look, it was openly discussed in the Israeli press that when Israel was losing the war in the early stages against Egypt in 73, Moshe Dayan pressed, the defense minister, pressed the prime minister to use nuclear weapons against Egypt. Now, she at that time said no, but the threat to use nuclear weapons was used as a threat to America, to force America to massively increase its sales weapons to Israel during that crisis, during that war. And therefore, the use of nuclear the value of nuclear weapons is not just in their use, it's in the threat to use them. And Israel's the only country in the Middle East and West Asia which has them, but which has also threatened to use them. Look, 2 years after that, and here's another argument why Israel cannot be trusted with nuclear weapons. I don't think Israel should be trusted with very much. But 2 years after 73, because the apartheid regime in South Africa later fell, we see the documents. And Shimon Peres was offering to sell nuclear weapons to the apartheid regime in South Africa. It seems like a comedy script, but he said we can give them in two sizes. And these documents are in the public domain at the moment. 10 years later, Israel bombed Iraq. You don't have to be a fan of Saddam Hussein to pay attention to this. Because when the Israelis bombed the Iraqi reactor, the Israeli Prime Minister at the time, Begin, he said, every Israeli government will act in a similar way whenever they suspect, as in can claim, that any of their neighbors are a nuclear threat to Israel. Shortly after that, Mordechai Vanunu, a humble engineer in Israel's nuclear plant, gave his story for free to the Western press, proving that Israel had not just atom bombs, but hydrogen bombs. He was kidnapped, injected from Rome, taken to Israel, and almost 40 years later, he's still detained in Israel for revealing the extent of Israel's nuclear weapons. And Vanunu revealed the arsenal at that time in 86, right, because he said it could not possibly just be for defensive purposes. So the record shows that there is massive Western collusion in Israel's nuclear arsenal, and it's protected. You know, there have been resolutions to the IAEA to force Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The US, UK, and Canada have consistently voted against even such motions as asking Israel to open its weapons to international inspection.
Exactly, yeah. And I want to put that question to Mimi Alam. The US, UK, France, and others, they are stopping this. Nukes are threats to everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a Jew, Muslim, or whatever. Nukes are nukes, right? So nukes, if Iran pursues it, or other countries, it's a threat. If Israel doesn't pursue it, it's not a threat?
Well, it's interesting. I believe a couple of years ago, the Russians came out with a report saying that Israel has 80 to 100 nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And clearly, like, this number of bombs could annihilate an entire country. And once they go flying into the air, of course, that means that everyone's going to notice that this is the doctrine, mutually assured destruction, the belief that once someone uses nukes, it's possible everyone's going to start using nukes. And so this has, of course, a nightmarish scenario associated with it. The problem is that the nukes already exist. The United States, the UK, Russia already have them, of course, France and China and India and Pakistan as well. And illegally, Israel acquired them. This is already, they don't admit it, but Vanunu himself was a nuclear scientist who exposed this. Of course, the Israelis put him in jail for that. So given that Israel is not prepared to give up its nukes, and it's prepared to point the finger at other countries accusing them of nukes and making threats about nukes, I think it is actually in Iran's interest, and perhaps in the interest to stability in the region, to get nuclear weapons.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Mick Napier with the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Edinburgh, and also Mimi Alaham, journalist and writer with Al Mayed in English, joined us from Perth with their contribution. And that's all for this edition of the News Review. Now, moving on, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have protested in support of six Palestinians who escaped the high-security Israeli jail last week. The protesters gathered in front of the Red Cross building in Gaza City. Some of them were wearing handcuffs in a show of solidarity with the Palestinian prisoners. Israel has conducted a massive manhunt since last Monday when its six enemies tunneled out of the regime's Gilboa prison. Four of them have been rearrested. Early in the day, Israeli warplanes again pounded the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that the strikes are an attempt by the regime to divert attention from the successful escape of the Palestinians. Now for more information, and let's go to Gaza City. Ashraf Shan is there live for us. Ashraf, good to have you with us. So tell us about this protest that was held in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza and the overall situation there.
There was hundreds of protesters gathered inside and outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza City today in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners, especially the six SKPs who made the heroic escape from the Gilboa security, maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine last week. During the protest, people there shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded protection for all Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, and also especially those who were recaptured by Israeli forces. In front of the ICRC itself, Hamas senior official Mushir al-Masri warned the Israeli regime against harming those prisoners who were recaptured, and also reiterated the statement made by Abu Ubaidah, the spokesman of Hamas's military wing, the Izdin Qassam Brigades, who said that the six SKPs will be the first one on the list of any future prisoner swap deal with the Israeli regime Behrouz.
Okay, and Ashraf, do we know what happened to those four Palestinians that were recaptured by the Israelis? Because they were taken to court yesterday.
Yes, they were taken to the Nazareth court in occupied northern Palestine, and they were, I believe they were able to meet at least one lawyer, but we still don't know what happened to them, but for sure, those four prisoners who were recaptured by the Israeli forces were heavily interrogated and tortured, as we can see from the images released upon their capture. Two more are still at large. The Israeli regime says that they think that one of those SKPs has managed to enter the occupied West Bank, maybe trying to reach the Jenin refugee camp. If that scenario happens, there will be heavy clashes between Palestinian resistance fighters in that refugee camp and the Israeli regime, especially that 2001, I believe, there was a huge battle there between resistance fighters and the Israeli regime. And the one who was leading that battle is Zakaria Zubeidi himself, who was one of those four who were recaptured.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon, correspondent in Gaza. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has described as constructive his recent visit to Iran, where they reached an agreement on the agency's monitoring activities.
We had a very constructive trip to Tehran, and there is an agreement that we have now on important matters relating to the equipment and the continuity of knowledge that we will be establishing through it.
Grossi said that he'd go back to Iran soon for high-level talks with a new Iranian government on how the two sides will continue their cooperation in different fields. Meantime, head of Iran's nuclear body, Mohammad Islami, criticized the IAEA for its failure to adhere to its duties under its own regulations. Islami said that the agency should help all member states in their peaceful nuclear activities, but he said that this is not true when it comes to Iran, as the agency does not offer any help to that country. Well, let's go to Vienna to our correspondent there, Hamad Ezgi. I believe that that presser is over now. So you were there, and you also had your questions for Mr. Grossi. So overall, what was the atmosphere like? Was it mostly for Iran or against it?
Yes, Behrouz, that press conference is now over, and the IAEA board session is continuing as we speak. It's going to go on for this week, and we're expecting the Iran issue to be brought up, if not tomorrow, then on Wednesday, as I said before, when the Iranian ambassador, Mr. Fazan Gharibabadi, will also deliver his own statement to the board. Now, in this board session, the agency issued two reports on Iran, and in those reports, there were two issues that he raised concerns about. One of them was the issue of access to monitoring equipment in Iran, which was, as you well know, resolved with his visit to the country. So because that issue has now been, in practical terms, resolved, and the agency now believes it has the necessary information that it needs, although it does not have access to it, but that data is being recorded and will stay under seal, under IAEA and the Iranian seals, until the JCPOA is revived. This is, in the view of the IAEA, a successful arrangement, and that's why Mr. Grossi said that his trip to Iran was a very constructive one. The other issue that he's raised in his reports concerns about is the uranium traces that the agency says has been found in four different locations of the country, and he's saying that Iran is not providing adequate information on them or responding to the agency's questions. But the Iranian ambassador has responded to that, saying that Iran has been cooperating also under the previous administration. This is an issue that's been going on for some time now. It's not new. And Mr. Gharibabadi said that these safeguards-related issues, of course, are not current. They relate to Iran's past nuclear activities. They're not urgent matters. And those countries who are trying to portray them as such are trying to put pressure on the agency and to put pressure on Iran. But this kind of approach, Iran has warned, could only jeopardize the resumption of talks on the JCPOA.
Okay, hopefully. So keep an eye on that, and we'll come back to it later. Thank you very much for that, Homa Leski, our correspondent in Vienna. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insisting on the necessity to follow the health protocols concerning reopening mosques for prayers during the month of Ramadan, May 10th, 2020. The second point is that there is an unanswered question about praying and other religious ceremonies. Of course, I do not want to put forward any proposal to the National Anti-Coronavirus Headquarters about mosques, prayer halls, and the like. I follow the expert decisions made by the headquarters, but what I want to say is that praying and religious activities, in particular in the month of Ramadan, and in particular in the nights of Qadr, which are ahead of us, are one of the people's definite and fundamental needs. From one viewpoint, they are not that different from worldly needs, and from another viewpoint, they are even more important than worldly needs. The people need to be in contact with God to pray and to supplicate, in particular when important matters arise. Therefore, we should think of something for resolving this matter. I even believe that if strict regulations are imposed in this regard, our pious people and mosque frequenters will observe them more than others. In other words, if pious people are told that they should observe certain regulations when visiting holy places, mosques, and Husainiyas, I believe that those who are entrusted in attending mosques will observe them carefully. As I said, I have no suggestions in this regard, and I will approve of the expert and carefully studied decisions of the headquarters. But I recommend that you entrust this task to those who understand in the real sense of the word, the significance of dua, supplication, and spiritual matters. It is such individuals who should examine the matter and make decisions. Whatever decision they make, I and all the people will be obliged to implement them, God willing.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana latshan.
Imam Hussain, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Insisting on the necessity to cancel all religious gatherings in accordance with the regulations set by the National Committee on Combating Corona, March 22, 2020. I would like to reiterate again that everyone should act on the instructions given and announced by the officials of the National Anti-Corona Headquarters. They have even cancelled religious gatherings. Well, it is unprecedented in our entire history to cancel all religious gatherings in places such as holy shrines and public and Friday prayers. It is unprecedented, but there was no other option. They have determined it to be an expedient measure, and this is how they acted. The people should observe the instructions so that Allah the Exalted will help the Iranian nation, all Muslim nations, and the entire humanity get rid of this plague as soon as possible.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives. Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs because if these stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017. That gave $4.5 trillion in the tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away Trump tax cuts if they're going to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
Israel is stepping up its hawkish warmongering rhetoric against Iran. The chief of staff of Israel's military has said the regime is putting more extensive plans in place for when it decides to, quote, attack Iran. Aviv Kohavi claims the regime has, quote, greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. He says a considerable increase in the budget has been allocated to that purpose, with more intelligence and operational capabilities assigned. Kohavi also said Israeli military's current main objective is to stem what he called Iran's presence in the Middle East, with an emphasis on Syria and elsewhere. Those operations are taking place all over the Middle East, against Hamas in Palestine, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Earlier this month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz said in an interview that the regime was prepared to attack Iran, saying that, quote, "We are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran." Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has implicitly acknowledged that the regime has carried out covert attacks on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and brazenly said that the regime would keep on with such attacks.
And the reason behind its stepped up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Iran has already condemned Tel Aviv's reckless rhetoric against Tehran. Late last month, the Iranian envoy to the United Nations warned Israel against any adventurism toward the Islamic Republic. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Zahra Ershadi, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the UN, warned the regime against carrying out its threats of attacking Iran over its peaceful nuclear program. Unchecked, such continued unlawful acts and systematic provocative measures, with all their serious ramifications, would undoubtedly further destabilize the region and also endanger international peace and security.
It was not just when Netanyahu, with all of his ridiculousness, his cartoonish presentations and so forth, his obsession with Iran's development, it's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something.
Being Naftali Bennett's visit to the United States last week, Tel Aviv and Washington agreed to form a high-level team to tackle the Iran nuclear issue. Israel's threats against Iran are believed to be aimed at influencing stalled nuclear talks between Tehran and other world powers.
Well, Israel definitely wants to prevent any possibility of success for the a return to the JCPOA, the so-called nuclear deal. And so it's moving in this direction.
However, analysts believe Washington's options outside of diplomacy with Iran are limited. Military option would be unacceptable to the top Pentagon brass, who have engaged in enough war games and other scenarios to recognize that there is no workable military solution. It is believed that Israel presumably recognizes that a military option would also be counterproductive.
The United States marked the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The world will probably never forget that fateful day in 2001, which changed the course of history. U.S. investigators said the Al-Qaeda terror group was behind the whole thing. America said it had evidence showing that the attacks were planned and led from inside Afghanistan. This triggered the invasion of Afghanistan that bogged down the U.S. military for 20 years. Two decades later, the family members of 9/11 victims are still struggling to find answers. They have long been pursuing accountability from another country, Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who carried out the attacks were Saudi nationals. That is not all that ties the kingdom to the complicated plot. Long classified documents have revealed that some of the hijackers had been in contact and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They also show that the phone number of then-Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was in the phone book of a close associate of Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. The families of victims said in a statement last month that evidence implicates Saudi government officials in supporting the attacks. The families have long argued that Saudis had advanced knowledge of the plot, but did nothing to stop it. The families of the victims have been pushing for the release of more 9/11 documents that successive U.S. administrations have kept secret. Biden has made up his mind about the upcoming anniversary. He will visit all three sites where hijacked planes crashed 20 years ago to commemorate the victims. But will his administration give the victim families what they've been demanding so long? They want to know for certain if Saudi Arabia aided the hijackers. Some of the still-secret files relate to an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore that focused on the two hijackers who lived in San Diego and individuals who may have assisted them. A former FBI agent who was involved in the investigation has said that he is confident that the two hijackers had a U.S.-based support network. Riyadh still denies any involvement in the 9/11 plot. It is now fighting a lawsuit brought by the families in federal court in New York. Why have successive U.S. governments been reluctant to release the files so many years after the horrific event?
It has been a mystery why the U.S. has been covering up for connections to Saudi Arabia throughout these last 20 years. So that's why the 9/11 families have had their lawsuit and tried through the courts to get access to this information. But, you know, it's not just the 9/11 families. The entire public of the United States deserves to know what happened on 9/11 and before 9/11, deserves to know what connections the U.S. has been covering up for.
U.S. authorities have argued that any release of more files could result in damage to the national security. But some observers believe Saudi lobbies in America could have played a role in blocking the very long-awaited release. Top U.S. officials also seem reluctant to sour lucrative ties between America and the autocratic kingdom by thoroughly investigating the clues about possible Saudi government involvement in 9/11 events.
The close relationship that the U.S. government has with Saudi Arabia has made it very difficult for 9/11 families to get the access to the information they deserve and they need to prosecute the case that has been going on for 20 years against the 9/11 hijackers.
Will the Biden administration, which has promised more transparency, act differently?
The Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan in a matter of weeks and seized control of the capital, Kabul, without facing much resistance from the U.S.-trained Afghan security forces, as foreign troops and citizens were scrambling to leave the country before a deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden. The security situation at the international Kabul airport deteriorated to the point where U.S. intelligence agencies warned about an extreme risk to people present at or in the vicinity of the airport. On August 26th, a bomb attack hit the crowds outside the airport, killing over 180 people, including 13 U.S. military personnel. The attack was claimed by an offshoot of the Daesh terror group called Daesh-K. The Taliban said the attack took place in an area that was supposed to be secured by the U.S. troops. The group also blamed the U.S. and the hurried evacuations for the incident, saying there wouldn't be any bomb attack if the situation were calmer. Daesh-K has fought both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The Taliban now say they don't need international help to uproot the terrorists.
The U.S. has been 20 years in Afghanistan, has accomplished nothing good. The Taliban doesn't want U.S. involved anymore, but the fact that a country doesn't want U.S. involvement doesn't mean the U.S. will not be involved. Let's hope that this is ending, but that remains to be seen.
Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, had earlier floated the possibility of coordinating strikes against Daesh with the Taliban. The United States has no longer any army troops on the ground in Afghanistan, nor any air bases near the country. Washington, however, has pledged to continue what it calls fighting terrorism in the Central Asian country. The only way for the U.S. to carry out strikes on Afghanistan is by deploying its aircraft carriers. The U.S. is reportedly considering keeping its aircraft carriers in the region, including in the Arabian Sea, to continue its operations there. But that requires new calls for funds and creates some technical obstacles, including intelligence collection over such long distances. It also means that President Biden's claim about wanting to end America's endless wars is somewhat misleading. In the meantime, some U.S. politicians are expecting troops back on Afghanistan's soil.
We will be going back into Afghanistan as we went back into Iraq and Syria.
Are you seriously think the United States will once again, in a foreseeable future,
yes,
put troops back into Afghanistan?
We'll have to, because the threat will be so large.
But while even some of Washington's NATO allies have expressed their dissatisfaction with the outcome of the 20-year-long war, how is going back to Afghanistan feasible for the United States?
Lindsey Graham, of course, is very anxious to have more wars. He's heavily financed in his campaigns by military contracts to the U.S. In the 2020 election cycle, they donated nearly $400,000 to his campaign. So he has, and this is not new in 2020, he has often said how much he supports rebuilding the military, as he calls it, in order to protect U.S. freedom.
The fact that the Taliban came to power even before the foreign troops left Afghanistan's soil shows that the West's military intervention in the country can never succeed.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست. ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Dear brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. We take pride, and our noble and thoroughly committed nation is proud in being the followers of a school of thought which intend to dig out the Quranic truth, which commit themselves thoroughly to the unity of Muslim and even humanity from the graveyards and utilize it as the greatest perception for the disentanglement of men from all shackles on his limbs and on his mind and souls, which are leading him towards destruction, slavery and servitude to the oppressors.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Al-Khomeini was quoted saying, "A person who appears sad, whose face shows his affliction by tears, is actually helping to preserve the uprising and the movement of Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam." With Imam Al-Hussein salamullah alayhi, one of the dimensions and one of the reasons we cry for him, because we want to honor the Imam, glorify the Imam, give more focus and attention to his position and personality, that through him Islam is preserved. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ala, he said, "He who dies and no one mourns him, there is no honor in him."
When your horse returns to our camp rider, your son and I emerge out sorrowful. When your horse returns to our camp riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful. Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves?
Even Allah in the Quran, He says, when He talks about the Jews, He said, "فَمَا بَكَتْ عَلَيْهِمُ السَّمَاءُ وَالْأَرْضُ," nor the earth nor the sky cried for them. Meaning what? Meaning they had no value. They weren't valuable people. If they had value, then earth and the sky would cry for them. We understand from this ayah as well that for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the heavens and the earth wept for him because he was the guardian of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. So me and you, when we establish these morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, we're trying to show the world his unique and exceptional personality, that people through this act, they could come and get to know him a little bit more. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
the subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's Afghanistan debacle 20 years after the cataclysmic events of 9/11 that found expression in the so-called global war on terror. And we shall discuss why the US military-industrial complex decided to invade Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks and what actually was on the agenda.
The military invasion of Afghanistan 20 years ago kickstarted with the Pentagon carpet bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misjudged response to the 9/11 attacks turned out to be nasty, brutish, and long. The so-called war on terror only bred more terrorism as successive regimes in Washington sought to conceal the truth. The futile military adventure that consumed millions of innocent lives finally ended with the way it started: suicide bombings and drone strikes in the heart of Kabul.
Less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on September 11, 2001, killing 2,977 people, including 2,606 people at the Twin Towers and 125 at the Pentagon, then U.S. President led an invasion of Afghanistan, backed by an international coalition. The stated objective was to hunt down the alleged mastermind, the former CIA ally and al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden, who was hosted by the Taliban. As the U.S. sent long-range B-52 Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130 Spectre gunships and MQ-9 Reaper drones to bomb the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn into America's longest war in history.
September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States.
Barbara was labeled a traitor by those who championed the 20-year military adventure that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The so-called war on terror over the years only spawned more terrorism while failing to achieve any of its stated objectives. 20 years down the line, the Taliban are back in power, al-Qaeda still exists, while the Americans have been forced to pack up and leave.
It's way past time for Americans to question all of these interventions. Of course, you know, our press goes absolutely apoplectic, you know, crazy at the thought of some foreign government possibly trying to have some kind of interference in our elections. And here we are literally going around the world laying waste to one country after another. And I think the consequences of these interventions tell the whole story, truly. You know, over the course of the last 20 years, there are at least a million people dead, and I think that's far below the actual figure. Tens of millions of people have been displaced from their homes. This has created all of these waves of refugees in these crises around the world. In addition, we have thousands of Americans dead, and we've, again, spent all of these trillions, and that's just the money that we know of. I think that number also is probably quite low, but estimates have been $6 trillion.
So we've been literally hemorrhaging resources and focus and money to these conflicts that have been disastrous one after another. And our own country is facing, you know, many serious issues, including a horrific deficit and debt, and we need to stop this hemorrhaging.
The Americans launched the invasion of Afghanistan on October 7th, 2001, on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and to capture the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. That was the stated objective. But the real agenda was more sinister, to militarily occupy the strategically located mineral-rich South Asian country. While the American public initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, the support waned as the futile war dragged on, metamorphosing into a worst U.S. foreign policy disaster.
On the fateful afternoon of October 7, 2001, as the U.S. and allies started the three-week deadly bombing campaign in Afghanistan, dubbed the Operation Enduring Freedom, then U.S. President George Bush said the objective was to destroy Al-Qaeda, decimate the Taliban regime, and prevent the repeat of 9/11 attacks.
The Taliban regime is coming to an end.
The core objective was achieved in 3 months, but the Americans decided to continue the occupation. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the U.S.-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan, strategically located between Central and South Asia. It was clear from the way the Bush administration snubbed Taliban's offer of truce to prevent bloodletting. Before the bombing campaign began, the group offered to hand over bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the US-backed government in Kabul led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a misguided 20-year military adventure that ended in disaster.
This is in keeping with the policy of forever wars and never-ending wars. The purpose of the invasion of Afghanistan became, if it wasn't always the case, became a question of sustaining the various operations, the money-making operations that were going on there. So, you know, we see the same thing in Syria. I believe ISIS would have been completely defeated years ago, was it not for the U.S. illegal occupying troops there. So you don't want to get rid of the justification that you're using for the occupation that you're involved with. And, you know, this is how you keep wars going on for 20 years.
Even Americans woke up to the bitter reality years after rallying behind the war in Afghanistan. The worst U.S. military and strategic debacle not only failed to achieve its objectives, but laid bare America's global hegemonic project.
The key objective of invading Afghanistan immediately after the 9/11 attacks, as emphasized by Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, was to, quote, find, stop, and defeat every terrorist group of global reach. The goal was practically unrealistic and unachievable. 20 years on, the threat of terrorism not only persists, but has assumed alarming proportions. Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while the Daesh militant group has mushroomed in Afghanistan under the shadow of U.S. forces. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it.